Let's go ahead and open to Jeremiah 30, Jeremiah chapter 30 today. Most of us have studied prophecy to a degree anyway, and we have had a number of sermons given in this organization, and we have all heard a number of sermons over the years discussing various aspects of prophecy. And some of the highlights are of which are the rise of a powerful world empire at the end of the age, known as the Beast. And it's understood that this, is it a little hot? You can just turn, it has my name on it over there, just turn it down a little bit. Microphone is a little loud, I don't know why. Any case. So it's understood that the last stage of this empire, this powerful world empire, will be a confederacy of 10 nations pictured by the 10 horns and the 10 crowns and the beast of Revelation. And this will also consist of an alliance between state and religious leaders. The beastly empire will rise up out of Europe. And this is understood when we consider the history of the empire, the stages, the seven stages or eras of that Babylonian or Roman empire. And I'd given a sermon a while back about the history and of the German and the Assyrian people considered in prophecy. So we know that those people will play a significant role in end time events. And we've even seen reading some of recent news that United Europe is currently building an army, a military. They're allotting funds and resources to establish this military force that can be dispatched around the world, depending on the situation, when it is necessary. And so we know that wheels are turning, that chess pieces are being moved on this game board of life and aligned so that the events that are prophesied of in the scriptures will, in fact, come to pass. The wars and the rumors of wars seem to have already begun, but I think not on the scale as described by Christ in the seals of Revelation, at least not yet. And Christ said in Matthew 24 that at that time there will be great tribulation, and the strength of that tribulation will not be coming from the beastly empire alone. That other nations, other people will be involved, other forces at work. And these forces will include some of the great nations of today, found in some of the Asian and the Arabian countries. And so there has been this enormous buildup of European and Asian forces in recent years, and we see that China is increasing its technology and its strength in warfare, trying to compete with America. Russia has been making great strides in its military advances, its war machines, including, as we had mentioned in the question and answer period a few weeks ago, this mega submarine that they had built, the biggest one of its kind, biggest one ever built, and it even has the capability of launching underwater nuclear drones. And its article I had read this week says that the second submarine of this class is scheduled to be finished and in operation by the spring of 2020, with 30 more nuclear-capable drones that will be ready and operational by the end of fall 2020. And so we see that Christ's words stating that unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved, that these words ring true when we consider the capability of modern warfare to destroy all life on the planet many times over. And this is, in fact, one of the required factors of end-time events, of the beginning of the end of the age. And even though a movement to disarm nuclear missiles and warheads began, or was put forward anyway, in the 1980s, it seems that it never really gained much traction, and it has, in fact, been scrapped altogether among the nations today. And so when this tribulation that Christ prophesied of begins, Daniel also prophesied, saying that the great angel archangel Michael will stand up, and this angel will protect or deliver certain individuals from a time of trouble, such as was, and his, these are his words, a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation, even to that time. And so this is the same time that Christ described in Matthew 24, 21, when he said that there will be great tribulation, such as has not been since the beginning of the world, until this time, no, nor ever shall be. And we are all aware of the history of various forms of tribulation that has struck the world at different times throughout history. And so all of that that we have seen, probably the worst of which is found in the atrocities of the Holocaust and World War II. But what is coming is going to be far worse even than that. And so this time of tribulation includes a time of Jacob's trouble, and this is described by the prophet Jeremiah in Jeremiah in chapter 30, in verse 7, where it says, "Alas, for that day is great, so that none is like it, and it is the time of Jacob's trouble." This goes right in line with Daniel's prophecy. Christ's prophecy say that none is like it, no, nor ever shall be. And it says that Jacob, the people that carry this name, will be saved out of it, though they will not be entirely destroyed. And so it is that at the end of the age, there will be a yoke being put on the necks, figuratively speaking, somewhat literally, of the people that carry Jacob's name, his descendants. And verse 8 of this same chapter indicates that those who carry Jacob's name will have been enslaved by foreigners. And this means that a foreign people will come and will overpower the descendants of Ephraim and Manasseh. Jacob, when he gave his blessing, he passed his name. He said, "Let my name be on them, Ephraim and Manasseh." And we see that those two great nations are the descendants, or have descended into the people and turned into the people of America and Great Britain and its provinces. And so those two great nations will no longer have the affluence and the influence that they have had throughout the world for the last several hundred years. Jeremiah 50. And so during these end times, I'm getting to the point of the message today, technically classified as a sermon. I think it's going to be a little bit different than our usual sermons, perhaps more like a Bible study, if you will. But during these end times, there are going to be many players of prophetic world events, many of which are described in the Bible. And some of these are the main players that are significant in the world today, we see, such as America and Britain, dominant nations such as found throughout some of the Arab worlds, and also China and Russia, that these nations will be players in end-time events. And Russia does have a role in events at the end of the age, and many do not understand what their role is. And this was brought up several weeks ago, or perhaps a month ago, when we had listened to a radio program given by Herbert Armstrong, and he mentioned Russia and prophecy. And he went through and was beginning to explain some of their role, and questions began to come about from some of our folk about what is their role? How does this play out? What is going to take place with these people in the far north? And so I think we've all read about it several times in the scriptures, and perhaps we understood what their role was at times, and these things kind of slip our mind on occasion, and maybe we've never really fully understood the subject, and I'm not sure everything about them or prophecy in general can be understood at this time. But over the last few days, I reviewed this material. I listened to some other messages given by Mr. Armstrong and did a personal study on the subject, and I wanted to try to figure out what is the role of Russia in end time events. Are they mentioned in the Bible, and in what way? And so I hope to give a message today regarding some of the information I've found. And I don't have all the answers. I don't claim to. In fact, I might raise perhaps even more questions than was initially presented. But there are answers to be found. And Jeremiah in chapter 50 is one of the places that discusses this. Because the Russian people today are related to a people known as Persia, or the Persians. And some of this evidence can still be found in their ancient cultural dress and their ancient cultural architecture, which does not look anything like the modern cultural architecture of Russia, but is Persian. And one article I had read, a historical article, stated that the Persians apparently sprang from a people from the hills of Russia known as Indo-Aryans as early as 2000 BC, and they began to settle in the area now known as Iran and along the Black Sea coast. And so along the eastern border of the Black Sea coast, or perhaps, maybe I'm getting it mixed up, it's the Persian Gulf, but it is in a similar area, a little further down north. But their capital city of Persepolis, there's ruins of this still stand today. Most of it is destroyed, but there are many ruins that are still there from these ancient people. And this was an area that was hailed as Persis, which led to their name of Persia. And this is on the coast of the Persian Gulf. And it's also recorded in history that Darius, who is a great king of the Persian people, that him and his army subjugated virtually all regions that touched the European part of the Black Sea, such as parts of Bulgaria, Romania, the Ukraine, and Russia. And so the Persian people eventually had conquered Babylon, that was under the leadership of Nebuchadnezzar and his descendants, and the Persian Empire flourished from the years 539 to 331 BC. And their takeover of Babylon was prophesied by Daniel long before it ever happened. And also it was prophesied by the prophet Jeremiah. And we're going to read about some of this in this chapter. But when we go through the chapter, I'm going to read a fair portion of chapter 50 and some of 51. We begin to see the duality in the prophecy of Jeremiah 50 of Babylon's fall. And he stated this, in fact, in the beginning of his book, when Jeremiah began to write or record his prophecies that were given to him by God. He said that the prophecies in Jeremiah 2 and verse 4 were for the house of Jacob and all the families of the house of Israel. And so Jeremiah was a prophet that whose ministry took place after, long after, the house of Israel, the families of Israel, had been taken captive, had been annihilated by the Assyrians, and they were no longer a nation in the north. And yet he was now prophesying during the time of Judah, before Judah fell to Babylon. And yet he begins his prophecies by saying that these are for the house of Jacob and all the families of the house of Israel, indicating their duality. And so many of God's words written by this prophet were for a later time, a long time after Babylon had fallen or was conquered by the Medes and the Persian Empire. And so I'm going to read some of this now and talk about it as we go forth. And we'll see that it does mention Russia in these events at the end of the age. And so today's message is going to be, again, more like a Bible study. We're not going to have the illustrations and not necessarily a Christian living message like we tend to give most of the time. But I think there are many things in here that can be helpful and perhaps will spark some further discussion on the subject after services and going forward. And so verses 1 through 3 of Jeremiah 50. The word of the Eternal spoke against Babylon and against the land of the Chaldeans by Jeremiah the prophet. Declare among the nations, proclaim and set up a standard or a banner. Proclaim, do not conceal it. Say, Babylon is taken. Bel is shamed, which is a reference to Baal, or, you know, Baal had various forms of idolatry. And Merodach is broken in pieces, referring to Marduk, which is another god of 1,000 names. False god, that is, of 1,000 names. Her idols are humiliated. Her images are broken in pieces. For out of the north, a nation comes up against her, which shall make her land desolate, and no one shall dwell therein. They shall move, they shall depart, both man and beast. And so we see the prophecy speaks of Babylon's fall to the Persian Empire, which came not only from the north, but from the east. The main, you know, the capital of the Persian Empire was actually to the east of Babylon. But as I had mentioned previously, Persia was conquering nations up into the north of Babylon and also of Palestine. And much of this these references are given from the perspective of Palestine or Jerusalem. And so when it speaks of these people coming from the north, a nation coming against her, it talks about a people in the northern part, or which would point directly up toward Russia. And so there is a duality in this, I think. The duality in the prophecies were fulfilled when Persia overtook Babylon, but they will be fulfilled in the future, a second time. And we're going to see how the prophecy, many of the details actually are specific toward the end time. And some of them are specific toward the first fulfillment of the prophecy. And this is not unfamiliar to us. We are very familiar with duality and prophecy. You know, we just finished going through the book of Amos and saw how the dualities of prophecy are numerous throughout all of the books of the prophets, actually. You know, whether it's Israel's annihilation compared to the time of Jacob's trouble, Judah's demise as well, the Exodus and how it reflects a second Exodus, and there are many, many prophecies throughout the scriptures that are dual in nature. And so when it comes to Jeremiah 50, Daniel, the prophet Daniel, had also indicated that before the abomination of desolation takes place, Daniel said before the leader of the end time Babylon the Great, the beast of Revelation, before he comes down and before he plants his headquarters in the Holy Land, or a headquarters for himself in Jerusalem, what causes him to act, and the prophet says, is news from the east and from the north trouble him. And therefore he goes out with great fury to destroy and to annihilate many. And so this talks about powerful forces from the east and the north, which point directly toward Russia, and also even further east going into the Asian nation of China and some of those nations that are on the eastern part of that continent. And so if we continue reading in verse 4 now, in those days and in that time, says the Eternal, the children of Israel shall come, they and the children of Judah together. And so again, the prophet Jeremiah he lived during the time of, you know, Israel had fallen already. And Judah had not yet fallen. But he's now talking about a future event after the Second Temple, because it was primarily Judah that came back to restore the Second Temple. But now he's talking about a time when the children of Israel and the children of Judah will come together. With continual weeping they shall come, and they will seek the Eternal their God, and they shall ask the way to Zion with their faces toward it, saying, come, let us join ourselves to the Eternal in a perpetual covenant that will not be forgotten. See, my people have been lost like sheep. Their shepherds have led them astray. They have turned away on the mountains. They have gone from mountain to hill, one false god to another, have forgotten the resting place. All who found them devoured them. And their adversaries said, we have not offended because we have not sinned. We have not offended because they have sinned against the Eternal, the habitation of justice, the Eternal, the hope of their fathers. But he says, move from the midst of Babylon, go out of the land of the Chaldeans, and be like the rams before the flocks. Behold, I will raise up and come against Babylon, an assembly of great nations from the north country, and they shall array themselves against her. And from there she shall be captured, their arrows shall be like those of an expert warrior, none shall return in vain. And so again it moves into this destruction of Babylon, talks about people of Israel and Judah being joined together, coming to eventually make a perpetual covenant with God. And then it moves to the destruction of Babylon. And here it says that it will come from an assembly of great nations from the north country that will array themselves against her. And so the first time Babylon was laid waste, it was at the hand of primarily two nations that were combined, that they had to combine their forces into one empire, the Medes and the Persians. And the next time, it appears that it will come from an assembly of great nations. And so it's interesting For example, that Russia, we all understand, was once known as the USSR. And as a reminder, that expression means a union of Soviet socialist republics. And so the USSR consisted of many people in that area, not just one nation. It was the Armenians, the Azerbaijan. Here's a list here. I'm going to mispronounce many of these. Belarusia, Estonia, Georgia, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Latvia, Lithuania, Moldavia, Russia, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, the Ukraine, and Uzbekistan. And so these are a lot of different people that are probably related in some ways. But could it be that this is part of the assembly that comes against Babylon that includes other great nations? And we see, I'd mentioned this in the Q&A last week, or when did we talk? A couple weeks ago when we talked about this subject. Maybe a month now. I'm losing track of time with everything that's going on lately. But in any case, in recent years and months, Russia and China are forming a very strong alliance, being not only on the same continent, but having very similar interests, one of which is they're not very fond of the West, not very fond of the United States. And there's this buildup of military strength in both of those nations. In verse 10 of this chapter, Chaldea shall become plunder. All who plunder her shall be satisfied, says the Eternal, because you were glad, because you rejoiced, you destroyers of my heritage, because you have grown fat like a heifer threshing grain and bellow like bulls. Your mother shall be deeply ashamed of you. She who bore you shall be ashamed because of their immoral activity. Behold, the least of the nation shall be a wilderness. The least of these forces will be a dry land and a desert because of the wrath of the Eternal. She shall not be inhabited, but she shall be wholly, wholly desolate. Everyone who goes by Babylon shall be horrified and hiss at all of her plagues. And it's interesting, if you think about it, that the ancient ruins of Babylon, some of which have been uncovered, lay in modern-day Iraq and Iran, which is vastly a desert, was uninhabited for hundreds of years. That place wasn't like that all the time. I mean, who would build their empire in the middle of a desert? No, it was a lush country at one time. It was fruitful and bountiful, supposedly housed one of the seven wonders of the world, according to ancient writings. But it's been deserted. It was deserted for a long, long time until eventually the Arab people came in and started to populate this place. In verse 14, put yourselves in array against Babylon all around, all you who bend the bow, shoot at her, spare no arrows, for she has sinned against the Eternal. Shout against her all around. She has given her hand, her foundations have fallen, her walls are thrown down. For it is the vengeance of the Eternal. Take vengeance on her. As she has done so, do to her. Cut off the sower from Babylon and him who handles the sickle at harvest time for fear of the oppressing sword. Everyone shall turn to his own people. Everyone shall flee to his own land. And Israel is like scattered sheep. The lions have driven him away. First, the king of Assyria devoured him. Now, at last, this Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, has broken his bones. And therefore, thus says the Eternal, God of hosts, God of Israel, behold, I will punish the king of Babylon and his land, and I have punished the king of Assyria. But I will bring back Israel to his home, and he shall feed on Carmel and Bashan. His soul shall be satisfied in Mount Ephraim and Gilead. In those days, and in that time, says the Eternal, the iniquity of Israel shall be sought, but there shall be none, and the sins of Judah, but they shall not be found, for I will pardon those whom I preserve. So again, we see the duality. There are specifics that are given that refer specifically to, mentions the king of Assyria, mentions Nebuchadnezzar specifically, and then it jumps right into something that is definitely specific to the end time, where it says, the iniquity of Israel shall be sought, but there shall be none. Well, definitely the iniquity of Israel has been found ever since, you know, their destruction by Assyria and also by their destruction through Nebuchadnezzar. It exists unto this day. But this speaks of a time when it will not be found. The sins of Judah shall not be found. He will pardon those whom he preserves. And so this is pointing again to the second Exodus, a fulfillment, a second fulfillment of the Exodus of old. And so as we continue reading this chapter and into the next, we see the duality of Babylon's past destruction and how it reflects a future destruction of Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots. And so let's read a few more verses, beginning in verse 22. A sound of battle is in the land, and of great destruction. How the hammer of the whole earth has been cut apart and broken. How Babylon has become a desolation among the nations. I have laid a snare for you. You have indeed been trapped, O Babylon, and you were not aware. You have been found and also caught, because you have contended against the Eternal. The Eternal has opened his armory and has brought out the weapons of his indignation. For this is the work of the Eternal God of hosts in the land of the Chaldeans. Come against her from the farthest border. Open her storehouses, cast her up as heaps of ruins, and destroy her utterly. Let nothing of her be left. Slay all her bulls. Let them go down to the slaughter. Woe to them, for the day has come, the time of their punishment. And the voice of those who flee and escape from the land of Babylon declares in Zion the vengeance of the Eternal God, the vengeance of his temple. So the vengeance of God mentioned here, I think it sounds very similar to the day of God's wrath. It's not only a vengeance on Babylon for her sins, it's a dual prophecy of the retribution that God will pay out to that system that Babylon had established, that system of false religion, of idolatry, that has resulted in countless acts of iniquity, countless acts of pain and suffering down through the ages. In verse 29, call together the archers against Babylon, all you who bend the bow, and camp against it all around. Let none of them escape. Repay her according to her work, according to all she has done to do to her. For she has been proud against the Eternal, against the Holy One of Israel. And therefore her young men shall fall in the streets, all her men of war shall be cut off on that day, says the Eternal. Behold, I am against you, O most haughty one, says the Eternal God of hosts. For your day has come, the time I will punish you. The most proud shall stumble and fall, and no one will raise him up. I will kindle a fire in his cities, and it will devour all around him. And thus says the Eternal of hosts, the children of Israel were oppressed along with the children of Judah. All who took them captive have held them fast. They have refused to let them go, but their Redeemer is strong. The Eternal of hosts is his name. He will thoroughly plead their case, that he may give rest to the land and disquiet the inhabitants of Babylon. Well, the land that God promises to give rest to has not seen rest since that time. Since the time of Solomon, actually, that land has not seen the type of rest that God speaks of. A sword is against the Chaldeans, in verse 35, says the Eternal, against the inhabitants of Babylon and against her princes and her wise men. A sword is against the soothsayers, and they will be fools. A sword is against her mighty men, and they shall be dismayed. A sword is against their horses, against their chariots, against all the mixed peoples who are in her midst, and they will become like women. A sword is just meaning weak, and weaker than warriors, male warriors, and they will fall. A sword is against her treasures, and they will be robbed. A drought is against her waters, and they will be dried up. For it is a land of carved images, and they are insane with their idols. It's crazy and lunacy, the kinds of worship that people, that men have dreamed up outside of God. And so it talks about, again, about this drought coming against her waters. And it's interesting that Cyrus, when he had conquered the area of Babylon, that he diverted the Euphrates at that time that ran through the capital area and dried up this area so that they would be weak. And he was able to conquer that once great empire. So the annihilation it speaks of here will be complete. And the Arabs that inhabit the land that was once Babylon today are not likely, descendants of those ancient people. It is possible that some of them might be descended from Babylonian, but that civilization was vastly wiped out at one time. A place that was once lush and green. It's an enormous desert throughout the Middle East. But again, this devastation that's being spoken of is not just for the Babylons of that age. It is for the Babylonian Empire in the future. Verse 39, therefore, the wild desert beast shall dwell there with the jackals, ostriches shall dwell in it. It shall be inhabited no more forever, nor shall it be dwelt in from generation to generation. But it is dwelt in today. As God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah and their neighbors, says the Eternal, so no one shall reside there, nor son of man dwell in it. Behold, a people shall come from the north, a great nation, and many kings shall be raised up from the ends of the earth, and they shall hold the bow and the lance. They are cruel and shall not show mercy. Their voice shall roar like the sea. They shall ride on horses set in array like a man for battle against you, O daughter of Babylon. So it's interesting. It talks about a great many kings, many nations coming down against her. And it now calls her the daughter of Babylon. And again, I think this points to the duality of the prophecy. That even though this revelation calls her the mother of harlots, referring to the religion of that is practiced by the Babylonian Empire at the end of the age, here it is a daughter of Babylon. And so the Babylon of old was led by successive kings from Nimrod down to Nebuchadnezzar, and the empire kind of waxed and waned in its affluence and its strength at times, but it was at its peak during the days of Nebuchadnezzar, pictured by the image of with a head of gold in Nebuchadnezzar's dream. But after that empire fell, as a result of God not restraining the power of the Medes and the Persians, the empire would only rise up again symbolically. That ancient empire physically had not risen since that time, but it would rise up again, beginning with the Roman Empire under the leadership of the Caesars. And we understand that the Greeks handed down to the Romans had adopted much of the immoral religions and the idolatry that came from Babylon. In verse 46, it says, at the noise of the taking of Babylon, the earth trembles, and the cry is heard among the nations. So when Babylon of old fell, it was an astonishing event. Eventually, news of it would be passed on to the nations. It wasn't like today where people could pick up a cell phone and take a video of what's happening in ancient Babylon and pass it around the world. No. But this talks of a time, the earth trembling and the cry being heard among the nations because of what is happening to Babylon. And so I think that this is a scripture that actually correlates to Revelation 18 and verses 8 through 11. It's worth having a note in your Bible. I'll just go ahead and read it. Speaking of the final stage of the Babylonian or Roman Empire at the end of the age, it says, therefore her plagues will come in one day, death and mourning and famine. She will be utterly burned with fire, for strong is the Lord God who judges her. The kings of the earth who committed fornication and lived luxuriously with her will weep and lament for her when they see the smoke of her burning, standing at a distance for fear of her torment, saying, alas, alas, that great city Babylon, that mighty city, for in one hour or very quickly your judgment has come, and the merchants of the earth will weep and mourn over her, for no one will be able to buy their merchandise anymore. And so this is something that will be seen by the world. The world will shake at that time as the plagues are being dished out. And God talks about, in fact, burning the capital city of Babylon and casting it into the sea. And so that will be an earth-shaking event. literally. And so we continue to see the duality in this prophecy that Jeremiah was given in chapter 50 and also into chapter 51, because the prophecy continues. There was no break here in what the prophet had written. So verses 1 of chapter 51, "Behold, I will raise up against Babylon, against those who dwell in Lebkemah, a destroying wind, and I will send winnowers to Babylon," speaking of people that will fan the fire, "who shall winnow her and empty her land. For in the day of doom they shall be against her all around. Against her let the archer bend his bow, and let him lift himself up against her in his armor. Do not spare her, young men. Utterly destroy all her army. Thus the slain shall fall in the land of the Chaldeans, and those thrust through in her streets. For Israel is not forsaken, nor Judah by his God, the Lord of hosts. Though their land was filled with sin against the Holy One of Israel." So again, pointing toward them being brought back, he's not going to entirely forsake Israel or Judah. "Free from the midst of Babylon, and everyone save his life. Do not be cut off in her iniquity, for this is the time of the Lord's vengeance." And this sounds much like Revelation 18:4, where he says, "Come out of her, my people. Be not partakers of her sins, so that you don't receive of her plagues." And here it says, "Do not be cut off in her iniquity. Everyone, try to save your life. Do not sin with her, for God shall recompense her. Babylon was a golden cup in the Eternal's hand, and this cup made all the earth drunk. The nations drank her wine, and therefore the nations are deranged." And what does that sound like? Drinking of the cup from this harlot, this woman, and becoming spiritually drunk, deranged. Sounds like Revelation 17, doesn't it? In the first verses, "The great harlot that sits on many waters, who the earth's committed fornication, and the earth was made drunk with the wine of her fornication." Speaking about spiritual fornication, religious harlotry. Jeremiah 51 and verse 13, let's go down to verse 13. It says, "O you who dwell by many waters, abundant in treasures, your end has come, the measure of your covetousness." And so again, who dwells on many waters? Well, I just had quoted Revelation 17, the great harlot that sits on many waters. This says, "dwell by many waters," but the King James translation says, "dwelling upon many waters." And I think it indicates the spread of that empire, her influence upon many waters, waters reflecting people. And if you jump down to verse 20 of this chapter, God explains here how he uses Gentile nations to unleash as a form of retribution against certain people for their wickedness. In verse 20, it says, "You are my battle axe and weapons of war. For with you I will break the nation in pieces. With you I will destroy kingdoms. With you I will break in pieces the horse and its rider, and break in pieces the chariot and its rider. And I will break in pieces a man and woman, break in pieces old and young, and I will break in pieces the young man and the maiden. And with you I'll break in pieces the shepherd and his flock. I will break in pieces the farmer and his yoke of oxen. And with you I will break in pieces governors and rulers." So he is talking about another people that he will use to unleash retribution upon Babylon. Verse 24, "And I will repay Babylon and all the inhabitants of Chaldea for all the evil they have done in Zion in your sight, says the Eternal. Behold, I am against you, O destroying mountain, who destroys all the earth, says the Eternal." And who has destroyed all the earth, or influenced nearly every nation, or I shouldn't say nearly, who has influenced every nation on the face of the planet since the beginning of their time? It's Babylon, who sits on many waters. I will stretch out my hand against you and roll you down from the rocks and make you a burnt mountain. So again, I think this is indicative of how God will set the city on fire and will, as the prophecy describes him, rolling it into the sea. They shall not take from you a stone for a corner, nor a stone for a foundation, but you shall be desolate forever, says the Eternal. And here again, set up a banner, proclaim it in the land, blow the trumpet among the nations, not just in Judah. Jeremiah wrote this in Judah, but this is saying, hey, these words should be proclaimed among the nations throughout the world. Prepare the nations against her. Call the kingdoms together against her. Ararat, Midian, Ashkenaz, appoint a general against her. Cause the horses to come up like the bristling locusts. Prepare against her the nations with its kings of the Medes, its governors, and all its rulers, and all the land of his dominion. And the land will tremble with and sorrow, for every purpose of the Eternal shall be performed against Babylon, to make the land of Babylon a desolation without inhabitant. Let's go over to Revelation 20. If you have a, well, let's see, I'm not going to go back to Jeremiah 50, but I'll be going to Ezekiel next. But I want to look at Revelation 20 for a moment, very briefly, because it's clear God has used other nations to punish. Is that even a word? It's not a word, is it? To punish other wicked nations. And understanding that much of this prophecy that we had just read in Jeremiah, in these two chapters, relates to the future, it seems that God will use a great and powerful military force to punish the future Babylonian armies, this empire that is known in the book of Revelation as the Beast. And so it would make sense, if you think about the logistics of it, would make sense that such a powerful empire at the end of the age, who would be able to come up against her to actually inflict damage? Well, nations such like Russia and China would be able to. We see that America and Britain are out of the picture at that point. They are not mentioned. They're only mentioned as being having a yoke upon them, a time of Jacob's trouble. But there are other nations that are going to continue to be strong, to have military strength. So Russian is mentioned, I think, in these two chapters that we had just read directly as a great nation from the north. It's evident that there are others involved, where it talks about other kings, other nations being a part of this. And but this is not the only place that Russia is mentioned in prophecy. There is another. But before we go ahead, let's read Revelation 20, because I think it's a helpful reminder before we read a couple of other chapters that declare prophetic end-time events. Revelation 20 and verse 7 speaks of the 1,000 years being expired, and Satan is going to be released from his prison, the bottomless pit, a dark place. And he will be released to go, be able to go out and to deceive the nations which are in the four corners of the earth, it says, Gog and Magog, to gather them together to battle, whose number is as the sand of the sea. And they went up on the breadth of the earth and surrounded the camp of the saints and the beloved city. But yet fire came down from God out of heaven and devoured them. And so this event will clearly take place 1,000 years after Christ has returned and he rules the earth for hundreds of years. And it's obvious that this hasn't not happened yet. This is not a dual scripture. However, could it be that something like it might occur near the end of the age? It's possible. And so I'm going to introduce something, and again, we're going to go to Ezekiel 38. Ezekiel 38. So some of this is speculative. There is some that is definite, and pardon me for a bit of speculation, but I don't have all the answers. I do not claim to, but I think this message does declare some of the answers, and perhaps we'll raise some more stimulating conversation on the subject afterward. But another mention of the Russian people is found in the book of Ezekiel. And Ezekiel chapter 38 and 39 foretells of a great battle that involves a people known as Gog and Magog, the same people that are described and Revelation 20. And these two chapters in the book of Ezekiel speaks of their uprising and the result of their uprising. And Gog and Magog describe a people that disregard God's commandments. But there are some specifics given in these chapters as to their identity. And so before we read them, understand that there is a prophetic event after the millennium when Satan is loosed. He goes out and he deceives the nations, gathers them together against the saints of the Most High in the capital city of Jerusalem. But like so many prophecies that we have read in the past and we just read in the book of Jeremiah, is it possible that this one that we are going to read is also dual in nature? Because there seems to be indications as we go through it that this final revolt that's spoken of in Revelation 20, that it shadows possibly a previous event that mentions Gog and Magog that participate in a great and enormous battle. So Ezekiel 38, in the first two verses, the word of the Eternal that came to the prophet Ezekiel, saying, "Son of man, set your face against Gog of the land of Magog, the prince of Rush, Meshech, and Tubal, and prophesy against him." So this is a prophecy including them, and it's actually going to explain something terrible that will happen to these people because of their actions. Now, the prince of Rush that's mentioned here is reference to an individual also known as Rus. And this man was a son of Benjamin. And it's believed that this man is the father of the Russian people, Rosh or Rus, Russian people. And it also mentions Meshech and Tubal. Now, Meshech, interestingly, lends its name to the capital city of Russia, Moscow. And these two individuals were sons of Japheth. And Japheth is believed to be the father of the yellow-skinned Asian people, such as the Japanese and the Chinese and Vietnamese and many others. Now, interestingly, along with the land of Magog, Gog here is symbolic of a leader. It calls him the Prince of Rosh, a leader of all these people. But there are others that are joined in this rebellion. And as we read through it, it brings to mind, of course, the gathering together of people from the four corners of the earth in Revelation 20. But Ezekiel 38 and verses 3 through 5, thus says the Eternal God, "Behold, I am against you, O Gog, the prince of Rosh, Meshech, and Tubal. I will turn you around, put hooks into your jaws, and lead you out with all your army, your horses and horsemen, all splendidly clothed, a great company with bucklers and shields, and all of them handling swords." And so it appears that God is leading them into battle, that he is causing them to want to go to war. But that's not the case. And we'll read that in just a moment in verse 10. It talks about these individuals having their own thoughts in their mind and them devising an evil plan. And this is why God says, "Oh, this is what you want to plan to do, huh? Well, I'll lead you the way. Let me show you the way then, down to where you will be destroyed." In verse 5, "Persia, Ethiopia, and Libya are with them, all of them with shield and helmet. Gomer and all its troops, the house of Togarmah, and the far and from the far north, and all of its troops, many people are with you." And so it speaks of here of people of Persia, and it says Ethiopia and Libya, which is interesting because the original expressions here are, Paras, which is much like Persia, and it does refer to the Persian people. But when it says Ethiopia and Libya, the original terms here are Cush and Phut, which are very different than Ethiopia and Libya. But I think the translators were fairly accurate in their translation because these two individuals, Cush and Phut, were sons of Ham, and we know Ham gave birth to Nimrod as well. But these individuals are believed to be the fathers of the dark-skinned or black people, which ended up becoming nations of Ethiopia and Libya, and then, you know, the African continent became dominated by these people. In verse 6, when it talks about Gomer and all its troops, the house of Togarma, people of the far north and its troops, many people are with them. Gomer is also a son of Japheth, and Magog was an individual who's a descendant of Japheth. And Togarma is a son of Gomer, so it would be a grandson of Japheth. And as we continue, it becomes evident that the location of the plundering of these people, that the, what is in their mind to go and plunder, the location that they want to go to or are led to is Palestine. And therefore, when it speaks of people from the far north of Palestine, what is far north of Palestine? It's Russia, is that location. But it says many people are attributed to these names, these people that have joined themselves with Magog or Gog. In verse 7, prepare yourself and be ready, you and all your companies that are gathered about you, and be a guard for them. After many days, you will be visited. So it's he's basically saying, be ready, go ahead and get yourselves ready. Something dramatic and traumatic is going to happen to you. And it says that this will happen after many days. And so this is indicative of a time after the second Exodus, after the posterity of the tribes of Israel are brought back into the Middle East, and they become a great nation in the mountains and the plains of Canaan. And so they now dwell safely in this location. But after this, in verse 8, after many days you will be visited. In the latter years, you will come into the land, and those brought back from the sword and gathered from many peoples on the mountains of Israel, which had long been desolate, they were brought out of the nations, and now all of them dwell safely. It's millennial is what is being mentioned here. But you will ascend, coming like a storm, covering the land like a cloud, and you and all your troops and many peoples with you. And thus says the Eternal God, on that day it shall come to pass that thoughts will arise in your mind, and you will make an evil plan. So it, here is their own mind, their own thoughts, and I believe being influenced by Satan, as he is allowed to deceive the nations once more. In verse 11, you will say, I will go up against the land of unwalled villages. I will go to a peaceful people who dwell safely, all of them dwelling without walls and having neither bars nor gates. And so it's evidence of people living in peace, people that have not learned the ways of war for a long time. And I will go up to a place having neither bars nor gates, and you will try to take plunder and to take booty, to stretch out your hand against the waste places that are again inhabited, and against a people gathered from the nations who have acquired livestock and goods and who dwell in the midst of the land. Sheba and Dedan, the merchants of Tarshish, and all their young lions will say to you, have you come to take plunder? Have you gathered your army to take booty, to carry away silver and gold, to take away livestock and goods, and to take plunder? Now, Sheba and Dedan, these individuals were also sons of Cush. But they are used representing nations that are neighboring Israel who are shocked about what is happening, about these people coming through here, a coalition of forces marching through, and they ask, "Is really? Is this what your intent? To go into this peaceful land? Did you try to plunder those people?" And therefore, son of man, verse 14, therefore, son of man, prophesy and say to Gog, thus says the Eternal God, on that day when my people Israel dwell safely, will you not know it? And then you will come from your place out of the far north, you and many peoples with you, all of them riding on horses, a great company, a mighty army, and you will come up against my people Israel like a cloud to cover the land. It will be in the latter days, and I will bring you against my land. Again, not God's doing, not inspiring their evil thoughts, but, okay, let's bring you down here. Here's where it's going to play out. When I'm hallowed in you, O Gog, before your eyes, thus says the Eternal God, are you he of whom I have spoken in former days by my servants, the prophets of Israel, who prophesied for years in those days that I would bring you against them? So again, it's reflecting back here. It's reflecting back to previous prophecies, even to the prophecy of this book, as well as, I think, reflecting the prophecies that now have long been written in the book of Revelation. In verse 18, it will come to pass at the same time when Gog comes against the land of Israel, says the Eternal God, that my fury will show in my face. For in my jealousy and in my fire of my wrath I have spoken. Surely in that day there shall be a great earthquake in the land of Israel, so that the fish of the sea, the birds of the heavens, the beasts of the field, all creeping things that creep on the earth, and all men who are on the face of the earth shall shake at my presence. The mountains shall be thrown down, the steep places shall fall, and every wall shall fall to the ground. And so it's talking about these systems of defense that are put up by Magog. I will call for a sword against Gog throughout all my mountains, says the Eternal God. Every man's sword will be against his brother. And I believe this is talking about confusion or paranoia among these forces, that they'll begin infighting among each other. And I will bring him to judgment with pestilence and bloodshed, and I will rain down on him, on his troops, and many peoples who are with him, flooding rain, great hailstones, fire, and brimstone. Thus I will magnify myself and sanctify myself, and I will be known in the eyes of many nations. Then they shall know that I am the Eternal. So clearly there are indications in this prophecy that this is an event that will take place after Christ's return. But there are words throughout that seem to point to a duality in this event toward possibly a previous event of similar magnitude. And I believe in this way it's similar to Jeremiah 50 and 51, where we just read about the duality of Babylon's fall. And again, this is not an unfamiliar concept to us, the duality in prophecies. But they speak of them when the prophecies are written. When we read Jeremiah 50, it speaks as though this is a single event. But we can see, because of the details of what is going on, it's not a single event. That there were two events. One did happen and one has yet to happen. And so not every detail in the prophecies relate to both fulfillments. We see that some of the details are specific to one or the other, but the theme, the aspects, many of them are the same, but not every element of the theme or the scenario is exactly the same. And so it continues into chapter 39 here, and it's the same thought. And you, son of man, prophesy against Gog, and say, thus says the Eternal God, behold, I am against you, O Gog, the prince of Rosh, Meshach, and Tubal, and I will turn you around and lead you on, bringing you up from the far north, and bring you against the mountains of Israel. And then I will knock the bow out of your left hand, and cause the arrows to fall out of your right hand. You shall fall upon the mountains of Israel, you and your troops, and all the peoples who are with you. I will give you to birds of prey of every sort, and to the beasts of the field to be devoured. You shall fall upon the open field, for I have spoken, says the Eternal God. And I will send fire on Magog and all those who live in security in the coastlands. So it's talking about people who live carelessly in the islands or in the continents, meaning nations thinking they can do whatever they want, and nobody's going to, you know, we're safe. It's a peaceful world. But God will send fire on these ungodly people, and they shall know that I am the Eternal. And I will make my holy name known in the midst of the people of Israel, and I will not let them profane my holy name anymore. And then the nations shall know that I am the Eternal, the Holy One of Israel. So some of the wording here seems to indicate that the millennium has not begun yet. And such as the words, the nation shall know that I am the Eternal, the Holy One of Israel. And so if this event were something that happened only after Christ returns, surely the nations would have learned war no more. Surely these people would have experienced centuries of peace and prosperity, of cooperation, and learned God's law and practice His law. We understand that the knowledge of the Eternal will cover the earth as the waters cover the earth and the sea. Surely they would have known that Yahweh is the Holy One in Israel. However, if this prophecy is dual in nature, then the fulfillment would speak of a time when the nations had not yet known exactly who the Holy One of Israel is. And so, but we see other parts of the prophecy indicate that it has to occur after Christ returns. So could it be that it's describing an event that will take place, perhaps, previously, but has not taken place yet? And also something that will take place after, long after Christ returns. God describing forces coming from the north to destroy armies of Babylon. After their victory, could it be that they turn to fight against God? Possibly even including this battle in the Valley of Megiddo. It's a possibility. I'm not saying that that is the case, but it's worth considering. Now we read the words of the second fulfillment here of this prophecy in verses 8 through 10. Surely it is coming, and it shall be done, says the Eternal. This is the day of which I have spoken. Then those who dwell in the cities of Israel will go out and set on fire and burn the weapons, both shields and bucklers, the bows, the arrows, the javelins, the spears, and they will make fires with them for 7 years. They will not take wood from the field, nor cut down any of from the forests, because they will make fires with the weapons. And they will plunder those who plundered them and pillage those who pillaged them, says the Eternal God. So the nations will not have learned war for centuries. And as a result, the rebellious armies here that come down, they will not be armed with machine guns and tanks and missiles, Humvees. none of this will have been available to them. There's not going to be a scrap pile where they can go build an army from all the scraps of the military that was left over after the tribulation. And so instead, we see here Gog and Magog will have fashioned arms that we would consider primitive, arms that are primarily constructed of wood. And because of this, it says that after the rebellion is crushed, that the peaceful people who will have been attacked, that they will be able to use those instruments for fuel. Now, for 7 years, they don't have to chop down anything for fuel. Ezekiel 39 and verse 11, it will come to pass in that day that I will give Gog a burial place there in Israel, the valley who passed by the east of the sea, and it will obstruct travelers because they there will bury Gog and his multitude, and they will call it the Valley of Hamon-Gog, which basically means the multitude of Gog. And for 7 months, the house of Israel will be burying them in order to cleanse the land. Indeed, all the people of the land will be burying them, and they will gain honor or renown for it in that day that I am glorified, says the Eternal God. And they will set apart men regularly employed with the help of a search party to pass through the land and to bury those bodies remaining on the ground in order to cleanse it. At the end of 7 months, they will make a search. And the search party will pass through the land, and when anyone sees a man's bone, he shall set up a marker by it, and the buriers will come to bury it in the Valley of Hamon-Gog. And the name of the city will also be Hamanoah. Thus they shall cleanse the land. Hamanoah basically means multitude. And as for you, son of man, thus says the Eternal God, speak to every sort of bird and to every beast of the field. Assemble yourselves and come gather together from all sides to my sacrificial meal, which I am sacrificing for you, a great sacrificial meal on the mountains of Israel, that you may eat flesh and drink blood. You shall eat the flesh of the mighty, drink the blood of princes of the earth, of rams and lambs and goats and bulls, and these are symbolic of people now, of the fatlings of Bashan. You shall eat fat till you are full, and drink blood till you are drunk. At my sacrificial meal, which I am sacrificing for you, you shall be filled at my table with horses and riders and mighty men, with all the men of war, says the Eternal God. So this sounds much like what? Does anybody? Sounds like the supper of the great God mentioned in Revelation 20 when he brings down all these birds of prey, these carnivorous animals, to basically clean it up. Hundreds of thousands, if not millions of bodies all over the place, it's going to need cleaned up. And so, this would be a terrible job for people to do, but hey, there are animals that can take care of such a thing. And so he will bring them down to devour those bodies. And then they will come out over and bury the bones. And so could it be another dual prophecy in this way? because the rest of the chapter goes on to describe Israel's restoration to the land among the nations for the glory of God. However, what we have read, we see that some of the aspects of this prophecy indicates that the restoration already took place, that his land or people are dwelling safely in Israel, upon the mountains and in the fields, that they are living in peace prior to these latter years. And so a conclusion that can be reached is that the prophecy of Ezekiel in 38 and 39 is similar to the prophecy in Jeremiah 50 and 51 in the sense of its duality. And we see that Jeremiah speaks of the happenings, the prophecies of Babylon, of Israel, of the Russian people, and we go into the mention of Gog and Magog in Revelation and Ezekiel 38. And other nations are included among the mix, but major players are mentioned specifically by name, at least by the name that God knows them as, descendants of Rosh, of Meshech, of Tubal, of Cush, of Jacob, of Judah, and so on. And so this duality in prophecies is nothing new to us. We're very familiar with the concept, but we don't quite understand everything, and I don't have all the answers, but there are answers to be found. And perhaps this message has answered some questions. It will likely give rise to others. But understanding the nature of these people, understanding that, hey, these scriptures actually make sense, and not reading them and going, oh, I have no idea. What's that mean, people from the north? What does that mean, Rosh and Meshech? What is that all about? I don't know. And so now we have a few more pieces anyway, and this can inspire us. It can help us to dig deeper into the scriptures to gain a better understanding of the future of what God is doing and what he will do. And this will also help us to have answers to people who might question the hope that lies within each of us.